Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Hello, everyone. Before we start the show, I wanted to make sure to note that this episode with Claire Headley was recorded before the passing of her close friend and colleague, Mike Rinder, in January 2025. That was a very recent and very big loss to the community. I'd known Mike for many years, and he's been a previous guest on this show. Mike and Claire, of course, did some amazing work with the Aftermath Foundation over the years, and after his passing, Claire organized a fundraiser to fulfill one of Mike's final wishes, which was for his supporters to consider donating to a college fund for his 12-year-old son, Jack. We've added a link to that fundraiser in the show notes of this episode in case you'd like to contribute.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Claire Headley. Claire Headley was born and raised in Scientology. She spent 30 years in the organization. She served as a high-ranking executive at the church's international base before escaping shortly after her husband, Mark. In 2023, Claire testified as an expert witness on Scientology in the Danny Masterson trial. Claire currently serves as president of the Aftermath Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting individuals who wish to leave the Church of Scientology, and it provides crucial assistance to those who lack a support system as they transition to life outside the cult. Find out more about the Aftermath Foundation by going to theaftermathfoundation.com. Here's Claire now. It is my pleasure to have Claire Headley with me today. It is so nice always to talk to you and to see you. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And same to you. I appreciate all that you do. And it's always a pleasure when we get the rare opportunity, it seems, to connect these days. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. I know that we recently talked for your show. I love that you have a show. Maybe you can spend a few moments letting people know about that so they know to look for it and to listen.
Yes, no, absolutely. My husband, Mark, and I both participate on Blown for Good on YouTube, Scientology Exposed. We do various different aspects of talking about our Scientology experiences there, interviews with former Scientologists, discussions on recovery from Scientology, all kinds of different things that we talk about there. And then it's also on a podcast format, but all the information is at blownforgood.com. So thank you.
Sure. Yes. And I think also the terminology blown for good, or that she blew or he blew, If you can give some history on that, because people might wonder about that bit of Scientology terminology.
Yes, absolutely. So the word blow or blown in Scientology is unauthorized departure, which of course to me simply highlights the fact that you have to be authorized to depart. And if you don't, there's a negative term in Scientology that is assigned to that. So blown for good is, it's kind of a little bit of defiance to Scientology of, yep, I'm gone and I will never be coming back. And of course, the history of that handle, Mark was posting about Scientology anonymously originally as Blown for Good, BFG. And that then put us on this path. His book, Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology, is also has that context of that word blow or blown in Scientology.
It is such a good book. I remember reading it, and I know I've talked to you about this, but it made my heart race. But in this way where, he writes in a way that mimics, I think, the tension, the intensity, the daily schedule, the needing to, kind of keep your stats up, do all your work and your escape and, being followed and watched and, right? And so, I could feel like my stomach tightening, my shoulders tightening as I'm reading it. But this is not to dissuade people from reading it. It's if you really want to kind of get a sense from a distance, the feeling of being there, he has a great way of having you even sensorily have an understanding, even for a minute, of what it's like to be there.
True. Yes. Mark is quite the storyteller. And I think that, he manages to make you laugh at times about things that you couldn't otherwise, under any other circumstances, possibly even envision for a moment laughing about. And that's just kind of the Mark's energy that he brings to the way that he elaborates on his story. And but I appreciate the mention, and Mark did all the hard work on that. I was the behind the scenes, putting everything together to get that book out. But
yeah, well, that's also the hard work in another way, right?
True.
Right. And so I know other times we've talked, I really want people to hear the other episodes with you where we talk about your earlier experiences and, having to be separated from family when you were very young and what that does and how healing and good and right it feels now for you to be a mom and to have relationships that are ongoing, that are involved, that make sense. And so please, everyone, take a moment or two or three to go back and listen to Claire's other episodes and to listen to conversations that you just have with others about these kinds of subjects on your show. I think today I want to be able to talk about a number of things like the distinction between people who got involved later on and others who were born in. And then also the idea of dealing with life transitions, both good and harder, and that sometimes a group like Scientology is going to give you a certain way of looking at all of those things, addressing them, responding to them. And a lot of people will say, I don't know how to do it now. I don't know if there's a certain way to think about life and death and birth those moments, the watershed moments in our life. I don't have a formula to follow. And now I'm also having a flood of emotions in a way that I might not have had before. So to talk about that. And then also some of the infighting that can happen between people who leave it. So we can start with any of those subjects. Those we could talk about those for days on end.
So for sure.
I don't even know now how to keep it to the amount of time that we want to keep it to. But what's the subject that you would actually like to start with?
Well, so I think that you talked about transitions and dealing with life situations and so forth. And to me, that's, you know, this time of year especially tends to highlight the struggles that many of us face with disconnection. So, for example, in my case and in Mark's case, we were disconnected from all of our immediate family in January 2005 when we respectively escaped. Obviously, Mark escaped before I did, and I followed 3 weeks later. And the day after I escaped, my mom, my stepdad, my siblings, I have two sisters and a brother, and they were all called in and told they could never talk to me ever again. It's one of those things that it does highlight the evil of Scientology, the control mechanisms of any cult to me, when they systematically undermine the power and human nature of the connection of family. And so I've always put it in the context of it on my own journey of healing and recovering from Scientology through therapy, through reading books and various other things. I've come to terms with the fact that unconditional love does not exist in Scientology. And in my experience from having been born into Scientology, the support from my mother, for example, was always kind of dependent on, was I cooperating with and, you know, doing all the things I was supposed to as a child being raised in Scientology.
Right, which says so much. I envision this kind of visual of a parent and a child on either side of the building, of whatever building I think of when I think of Scientology. Often it's the blue building, whatever, the Celebrity Center, all whatever buildings I come across, like in my life, in my day. But I think that there, you know, that there is this structure, this thing that rests between the two of you. And I feel like a parent-child relationship is this very sacred thing, and nothing and no one should get in the way. But it is true. It seems very conditional in a way that I think, and I know you think it shouldn't. And so what was the way you were supposed to behave in order to have your mom feel like she could even have a connection with you or respect you as a child?
Yeah, great question. So, and of course, you know, I'm not sure if you know or not, but I've been working on writing my own book and processing a lot of my cadet org years of experiences that I never processed. And for context, for anyone listening that's like, what the heck is she talking about? the cadet organization has no longer exists as of today, but I think it started in the early 70s, to the best of my knowledge, like for essentially with the creation of the C organization, members of whom commit to a billion years. Originally, if they had children, those children would be placed into the cadet organization, which is where those children would then be prepared for the same billion year service that their parents were carrying out. In my mind, the best description to understand the cadet organization is orphanage meets Lord of the Flies meets Nazi youth. That's kind of like the combination that I would say best describes that experience, because it's children running children, and it's like very little adult supervision, very little parental interaction. And my mother joined the C organization when I was 4 years old. So from age four until 10, I was part of the cadet organization. And what that looked like as a child growing up is, during most of that time, if I was able to see my mother for 2 or 3 hours once a week, that was doing pretty good. There were other times when she had been assigned to the Rehabilitation Project Force, for example, for sexual misbehavior on my mother's part. So while she was on that program, I wasn't allowed to talk to her at all for several months. or other times she'd be sent to Europe on recruiting projects. Again, I wouldn't see her. And she was a single mom, so it's not like I had other family. So I would just get assigned to random families like, oh, this person's going to look after you while your mother's in Europe for several months. You know, it's just, again, it's this consistent, it's not even undermine of family foundation. It just didn't exist at all. It was never even, it was never given priority. So, you know, in retrospect, you go, as a child, to me, that was my quote unquote normal. That was just my life as I knew it. And I didn't have any other experience or context to, you know, think that there was anything wrong with that. So, and again, when I had kids of my own, it really kind of threw me for a loop that I had to work through to kind of process, like, oh my gosh, I was, you know, for example, when my oldest son turned 4, it was hit me in the face like a ton of bricks. Like, oh my gosh, that's how old I was when my mother joined the C organization. You know, milestones like that, that I've gone through myself now as a mother of 3 boys, have been very significant in terms of processing all the emotions and gaining perspective and realizing exactly that my childhood was a complete train wreck because I was born into a cult.
Right. And I guess that perspective too, like you're saying, when your child is 4 and you couldn't imagine not seeing them for long stretches of time or being in a totally different country from them, you know. I mean, I think you probably were doing something similar to me as a parent, and you had sort of the mom purse, you know, with the tissues and the Band-Aid and whatever else, like just tending, right? It just comes naturally.
Yes.
And so to have that cut off, to have the coldness that comes with that is really incredible. When you were saying that it was so consistent, it's like consistent inconsistency or consistent unpredictability. You just never knew what was going to be happening and who was going to be taking care of you. And I'm sure there are some people who are more qualified than others. And especially if there were kids watching kids, they definitely were not qualified.
No.
But whether people were qualified or not, you still wanted your mom.
Yes, completely. No, exactly. Most of my childhood was this battle of, I just want to spend time with my mother. That's it. That's all I want. And then even the time that I did get to spend with my mother, I often felt that we had this kind of strange role reversal where she would talk to me like I was an adult, of course. And that goes back to the Scientology belief that children are adults in small bodies, I think is paraphrased the statement from Hubbard, which, you know, obviously, nothing could actually be further from the truth. A child is developing in every way for many years and requires nurturing and love and support and, you know, all the things that a parent interacts with a child. So our roles were always reversed because of the Scientology element. So, you know, very often she would talk to me like as if I was her sister or her, you know, older sister even. And it didn't occur to me, you know, that again, that was just the relationship that we had. But obviously, as you know, again, having children of my own and on my own recovery path, I've gained very different perspective on the reality of my childhood.
Right. And that you would know that there's a boundary. You're not going to open up about everything with your young kids. And they're also not responsible for you. You know, that
right.
That there is this hierarchy that is okay and natural. You think about how much Hubbard just did not know. As much as he seemed to say that he was an expert in so many areas, he really knew nothing about children and child development and family relationships. And even brain development, that, you know, it doesn't fully form till the mid-20s. So you really are not an adult, really, until you already have surpassed being an adult for a few years. It's really interesting. And it's so sad. And I think about then with a role reversal, who took care of you? Like, who could you lean on? And I think you just really learned to do it on your own.
Right. Yeah. It's complicated in terms of, and again, just trying to understand the day to day of what was it like? But yes, it was, there was no one to lean on, no shoulder to cry on. None of that, because of course, you're not supposed to cry. That's dramatizing. You're being banky, you know, blah, blah, blah. All the language that shuts down normal emotions that children have to learn to process. And I remember having I've cited the conversation you and I had many, many times about from years ago, where I was really struggling during deposition when Mark and I had a pending lawsuit against Scientology. And it was brutal emotionally because Scientology's lawyers were using emails from my mother and private correspondence to just really intentionally try to undermine my strength. And I was really upset several times driving my children. And anyway, the long story short, I was trying to approach this from, I wanted to remove my emotion and my grief because I didn't want my kids to see me upset. And I remember you saying, but why not? It's actually good for kids to see normal emotion. And I was like, wait, what? And after that, I remember my oldest son was like 3 at the time. And he was like, are you okay, mom? I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. I'm just having a rough day, but it'll be better tomorrow, you know? And then he started using it from that point forward. He's like, oh, dad's having a rough day, but he'll be okay tomorrow. And again, it's such a silly example. It's not silly, but you know, it's such an obvious example that to me kind of highlights the difference between how I was raised versus, you know, patterning normal emotions for children. And if you have a bad day, it's not the end of the world. You can work through it. We can do hard things and lean into each other and do better the next day.
Right. Oh, I'm so glad that, yes, I'm very glad that was helpful. And there's so much to that that is very interesting. And isn't it sweet when you hear your kids quoting you back to you?
Yes. Yes.
Oh,
I know.
That's a message they took in. That's great. That's great. Okay.
And that can go both ways. It can go both ways.
Totally.
But in this case, it was great. And my youngest son does the same thing too. He's, yeah, they're such a blessing to have. You know, these boys in my life that I don't try to hold my emotions in. I've tried to get better at crying, better at letting it out, because from my childhood, I just tend to volcanically hold it in until it erupts, and that's not healthy either.
Right. It erupts or it leaks out in other ways, you know, like an edginess or an impatience or something, because it's indirect, but you're still having it and it's needing to come out. There's also this interesting thing that happens, I've noticed, with people who've been involved in Scientology and a lot of other groups that have kind of a psychological bent, where you think that you're learning how to manage and kind of be dominant over and control your emotions. But really, you're learning how to ignore them. You're learning also to put them down. So you see it as a manipulation or a weakness or whatever else you're told that it is. And a lot of women are told that too, when they're crying, that's a manipulation, which is so incredibly frustrating. And children too are told,
yes,
you're just trying to manipulate. And kids will sometimes cry to manipulate, fine. But very often it's because they don't have words. They are showing their emotion with their bodies. And there's a reason that we can produce tears And so they kind of serve a purpose, and sometimes just for communication and connection. Because if you're crying and a person next to you is also crying, you've now connected over a similar emotion or a similar impact over something. And that helps with the feeling of community. There are so many positives to it. But I also think people become afraid of emotions. And so if your son gets to see that you're having a rough day or you're emotional and crying, and then the next day things are better or a little better, or that you cry and then you stop, then he gets to learn you don't have to be afraid of these emotions. You can just have them kind of wash over you. You can be in them and then go to the next part of your day and not have to go, no, I'm not feeling the thing because,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
I think that just makes it a very somehow a scary thing and something you have to suppress.
No, absolutely. And I think from this perspective of how that rolls out in Scientology, to me, it's a double-edged sword, because like you were asking, like what my relationship was like with my mother, for example, like what did I have to do to retain her support? So one of them was not crying. Like anytime I would cry or get upset, she would refuse to talk to me at all. She would just like shut me out because I was dramatizing. So therefore she would not even talk to me until I stopped crying.
Wow.
So then you're right. You learn to suppress it and hold it down. And then even in responding to crying, of course, in Scientology, Hubbard dictated the theory of the emotional tone scale. And so 0.0 is body death. It goes all the way up to 40 is serenity of beingness, and minus 40 is total failure. This is all nonsense. But the point being that in Scientology, sympathy is very low on the emotional tone scale. So responding to grief or human emotion with like, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry, you know, that's a negative. It's something that Scientologists and I, as a young child, was told was a bad thing to do, that was like, you know, it's depicted as covert hostility 1.1 with the person with the smile on their face holding the dagger behind their back. That's, you know, so again, it's all this negativity associated with normal processing of emotions that as a child growing up in Scientology was simply not patterned at all.
Incredible. And so when you look at these sorts of things and, you know, when you have a bit of a distance from it, I think you can ask why. Like, why was that something that was part of this tone scale? I mean, having a tone scale in general, so disorienting. Like, what do all these things mean? And I think I'm being a therapist. I'm somewhere with rats on this tone scale of whatever I am. But then you also wonder why. Like, what was he afraid of? Why did he want to make people afraid of therapy? And why would he be against sympathy? And I wonder then if he just didn't ever receive it. So it's like, if I didn't get it, I'm going to make sure no one else gets it. Or did he not want to have to feel responsible to ever give it? That he could then mistreat people, do whatever he was doing, lie, cheat, hurt them, but not feel like he needed to offer sympathy and come up with this way of formulating it where it's that he's not giving sympathy for your benefit, that it's going to help you because it's really covert hostility. I really wonder what the driving force for people who come up with these ideas really is.
Right. No, it's a good question. And again, just from my perspective, and from everything I've gone through and looking back at it, it strikes me most as one of the many control mechanisms that have been built into the indoctrination of Scientology and other cults too. It's not unique to Scientology. I just think that Hubbard probably even studied the effective control mechanisms in other cults and to use those to his advantage. Because if you consider that sympathy, withholding of sympathy is a way to also not have to explain anything that you do to anybody ever.
Right. That's so true. That's so true. Okay. So going to this idea of disconnection and also just dealing with life transitions and this time of the year, especially, you know, I talk about the holidays being a time where we see who's there and we notice who's not there. And so it's sometimes a harder time for some. And people will sometimes contact me and say, I used to have a way of handling these sorts of things. Sorry for the word handle. I know it's...
That's okay. Okay. Thanks for acknowledging it.
Right. There's just so much terminology that this Scientology has taken over and redone.
I know.
Right. But that, you know, they had a way of kind of shutting down feelings, that this is all, you know, like the idea of death in Scientology is a whole other idea where there isn't really a lot of the room for sadness, I think. And so now what do you do if you're suddenly having emotions? Because you can't follow this formula that helps you put it all away, because you might think maybe that's actually not so healthy and it's keeping me from being totally present. And then what? So if you can just describe Scientology's view of life, and I know the whole silent birth thing, but the sort of life and death, and if there were emotions that were allowed in, when you thought about these transitional times.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I have very distinct memories as a child relating to this exactly, but which I will explain. But I wanted to comment too, even in regards to the sympathy and the emotion piece, that the other element that is, I think, very deceiving and destructive when it comes to your own emotional well-being growing up in Scientology, of course, I'm talking about my emotional well-being, was the concept that once something has been addressed or you've talked about it in Scientology's counseling, then that should be handled, to mention the word handle. And therefore, it's done. We're moving on. And if you keep talking about it or you keep bringing it up, then it's an indication that Scientology didn't work on you, which is, again, a negative. So it does have the opposite effect of being directly contrary to the ideas even posed in the first place, like that a Scientologist thinks that they can communicate about anything. And yet my mother won't talk to me. So how does that work? You know, why? Just because I wanted my freedom and I wanted a different life and that I, you know, opted to never believe in Scientology ever again. That's my choice. That's my choice. And I accept her, you know, her choice, but anyway, so the condemning of any kind of action or, you know, diversion from the path of Scientology, our way or the highway, you know, that whole thing. Putting this in the context of my childhood, the struggle for me was that I was in the cadet organization studying Scientology and Hubbard every day from the age of 5. So I learned very early on that Scientology does not believe in heaven or hell or anything like, you know, but instead believes that the person is a body and your soul is a thetan, is what Scientology calls it. And that when your body dies, you the thetan, go to the nearest hospital and pick up a new body. So, you know, it's different than the idea of reincarnation as I understand it. I haven't studied reincarnation, but it's not that you come back as the same person. It's just that you are reborn and the cycle starts over again. But factor in this context now, and again, from the age of 5, I was going to public school. So primary school in England is elementary school in the U.S. Primary school at the time, anyway, I don't know if it's still the case now, was run by the Church of England. So we would, the headmistress would read to us from the Bible every day, and we would sing hymns. And, you know, so it was such a struggle mentally to be like growing up in, on the one hand, like we're going to church and this and that, the other thing. And on the other hand, everything I'm studying is very contrary to that. And so I didn't process that as a child. I just put it in separate buckets. But I remember very distinctly a conversation I had with my mother. I think I was 7, and she was telling me how she wanted to be cremated when she died. And this was just so devastating to me to, I honestly don't even remember why we were having the conversation, but I remember feeling flooded and overwhelmed with this emotions. And it was all linked to, you know, she was my only parent. And like, now we're talking about her being gone and cremated. I mean, oh my gosh, that was just over, like, and again, my mother just tried to reiterate, no, it's just the cremation is, that's just my body. I'll be, you know, in a new body. And somehow that did not work in making me feel any better about the situation.
No. You'd be like, okay, thanks. Yeah, no. Wow.
No. It was a struggle. And, you know, and since the moment I left Scientology, I was done. And I've described that as, you know, and again, this is in retrospect, but the truth of the matter is the moment that it became a choice for me as to whether I was a Scientologist or not, I chose no, bye-bye, done with that, not going back ever. But then I was faced with, well, then what do I believe? And I've just chosen I will never go the route of organized religion ever again, for sure. I would say it's a work in progress, but, you know, I do know, and I do subscribe to the belief, I don't know what happens after death. And I don't think that's what I believe. I don't know. So therefore, I'll choose to make the best of the life I have in front of me day to day and with those I love, and just do the best I can to pattern for my children kindness, peace, love, happiness, you know, make the best of what's in front of you type approach is my personal.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, that actually goes along with the way I was raised in the Jewish tradition where, you know, you live this life and that's it. But that's okay. I'm sure there are a lot of people who would still like to be able to believe that they're going somewhere, but it sort of sets up the system of rewards and punishments that is not something that Jews ascribe to. I think that's maybe also why there are so many Jewish activists for different causes, because they think this is the life we have. Let's make it something. Let's fix it if we can for ourselves or for other people. There's kind of an urgency, you know, about it. But I think it's still the hearing your mom speak with this kind of detachment. There are people who will say, I kind of want some of that. That's very appealing. You know, I'm flooded with fear about this and with emotion. And I want to just say, oh, I know I'm going to heaven, or I'm going to drop my body, or just the thing that makes me just not have to have an emotion about it. And so I think there are people who really do miss that. And it would make sense to miss it. It's not reason enough to get back involved. But you can just look at what felt nice about that. And I wonder now, with dealing with a real life situation, very unfortunately for someone who's been on the show, someone I've known for a very long time, someone who's very close to you and who you're very close with, and how you've been there, if you don't mind just taking a moment to talk about Mike and and just how to approach that and how it's felt different, I'm sure, with this situation than with others. And we're talking about Mike Rinder for people who didn't know that he's not well.
Yep. He has courageously been battling cancer. You know, Mark and I consider Mike, Christy, and their boys our family of choice, and our kids have grown up as cousins. So it's been very, very hard. Obviously, I think the right thing to do is whatever you can to show love and support and help bolster your friends and family of choice in whatever possible way you can. And that's the only time I will pray is when I don't have control over something, then in whatever form that takes, you know, it doesn't hurt to send out positive energy and love. And but yeah, it's very, very hard. And I've gotten very good at crying. But also I think it's important to lean into that as something to be grateful for outside of Scientology. Because so much of Scientology is dictated around mistrust and isolation and undermining, you know, of family relationships, of friends, you know, like isolating the member from every aspect of the outside world. So to have found family of choice outside and to feel the joy and the hurt and the ups and the downs, there's absolute beauty in that as well. You know, that I'm learning from. You know, it's a lot to process. It's very hard, but at the same token, there's joy and love and hope in that path.
Mm-hmm. It's really quite beautiful. And so imagine if this were happening and he were ill and you were all still in Scientology. Sorry for even thinking about it in that way, but how would this be playing out differently? Just so people have a sense emotionally, but also just in terms of how much interaction you'd have.
And it's a good question. There were many times, unfortunately, at least where we worked in this organization at the headquarters for many years, the incidences of people finding out that they had stage 4 cancer at the time that they even found out they had cancer was very, very common. And the reason for that, of course, was because a few different things. Number one, just a lack of access to regular healthcare. Number two was that we very often didn't sleep at all. We're malnourished, working very long hours. So you felt like crap all the time. So if you now have, you might not necessarily notice that you're feeling more crappy than normal. When somebody would be diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, they would be put on to essentially taken off their job. They might be even required to keep working on a shortened schedule. For example, and again, through the work that I do through the Aftermath Foundation, I've even heard of recent examples of this where an elderly man was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and was put on a reduced schedule of 40 hours a week. 40 hours a week was the reduced schedule for somebody in their late 70s. It just is an example of what's normal, quote unquote, in Scientology, when in any other world, that's elder abuse and absolute insanity, which is what it is, by the way.
Yes. And a full-time schedule still.
Right.
Right. Yeah. In the real world, right? That's the full-time schedule. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the, you know, in terms of the steps that would kick in if someone were, if a member of the C organization is diagnosed with advanced cancer, it's dealt with Scientology counseling. And it's not that traditional medical treatments are not authorized, but alternative treatments are very often preferred. And certainly the idea that Hubbard dictated of if you're ill, then it means you're a potential trouble source and you're connected to a suppressive person and all this other, you know, that all the mechanics of that are senior to medical interventions that prevent cancer. So unfortunately, we see many examples of prominent Scientologists or members of the C organization, public Scientologists who perish from cancer as a result.
Incredible. And I think, and I'm sure you've heard these stories too, of people saying they weren't allowed to go visit people in the hospital to be by their bedside when they were, you know, receiving care or just hospice care, or they just couldn't go to the funeral. There is something really amazing. I think about this with my dad, who unfortunately died at a very young age, and I was just 22 at the time. But I remember, and I've talked about this a little bit on the podcast, but I remember a neighbor coming and saying, I think you need to come with me. And I said, no, I don't. I don't know who you are. And I could tell by the look on his face, so he actually looked very upset. It wasn't like he was trying to ensnare me in something. And he said, I know your father. Sometimes we meet up and we go for walks, not together, but we just happen to be walking at the same time. We've gotten to know each other, and he's had a heart attack and he's in the street and you need to come. And so there I was, you know, at 22, leaning over him in the street, and ambulance is on its way. And so, you know, you kind of go into the state of, okay, I'm glad I'm here. And I need to tell my mom, I need to tell the family. Like, I went into the, what are my tasks? Because that's sort of how I help myself in certain moments, right?
Yes.
But it, as now a full-fledged adult, I think I actually felt kind of honored in some interesting way, now that I have a bit of distance from it, and you know, I miss them daily, but still, that I could sort of be there in that moment and be there with him for whatever, you know, if he was still alive or not, I'm not sure. But still, those moments, the transitional moments, the moments that people are kept from, are really sacred moments, you know?
They really are.
And so now you get to be a part of someone's life, but also a part of their death and a part of really showing them that they have a community and that people care and people are willing to make the effort. And not because they asked, but because out of the sense of friendship or love that people really want to step up. And that's a lovely thing. And I just think about all the people who are robbed from that.
Yes. Yeah. Though it's never too late. Never too late to take back, you know, the way that I look at it in retrospect, you know, in regards to my mom, my family, and everything else, is that yes, there are days that it's hard that they're not present. But the one thing Scientology will never take away from me is hope. That's my role from where I sit, is I'll never give up hope, you know, on anybody that I love and even on anyone that I don't know. You know, there's always, because hope is a powerful thing. And to me, it's how you can retain your own control over sometimes very difficult situations.
Yeah. Oh, I love that a lot. I wonder also if that's sort of tied in with the way I use the word yet. I think about when people are caught in something, or there's this sort of infighting that happens where people are attacking other people, and or they don't like if someone is, quote unquote, attacking the church, even though they're just sort of stating what was true for them in their lives, that I think they're not ready to look at this yet. And maybe that's me being hopeful that at some point, you know, they will get there. I wonder also, just thinking about the difference for people, like when you were saying, once you left, you left. You're like, bye-bye.
Yep.
It doesn't mean that even though you're done with Scientology, it's necessarily done with you, right? They still came after you.
Completely.
Right?
Yeah.
And still do. And I'm sure the Aftermath Foundation, you know, you need to have your kind of Wonder Woman like deflector bracelets on all the time. But I wonder just about being a next generation member and how that might make things different for people who leave, you know?
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's something that I've been considering a lot lately because I do think that, like in my case, Scientology was never a choice for me. I was born into it. And so pose a different reality where I didn't grow up in Scientology. I'm not sure. Like maybe if my mother had dropped me off at the fire station, you know, that then I wouldn't have been. Or, you know, but obviously I wasn't going to raise my hand in the hospital room and be like, I don't want to go home with this family. So, so it's just being born into it. I think I have no prior memories where Scientology wasn't baked into the equation. So I just look at it and go, and again, it's not comparing trauma or comparing experiences. I just think they're two different experiences that are likely even driven by very different reasons and rationale. But for somebody who, like, take the example of my mother, she was raised Roman Catholic and she was, she joined Scientology of her own free will as a 17-year-old hippie rebelling teenager brought in by her brother. So in other words, just very different experience. She had obviously things going on in her life that Scientology was an alleged solution to, that is what drew her into the trap. That's where I look at it and go, there's just two very different scenarios there. Like if I'm evaluating from my end how I got into Scientology, there's not much I can do about that. I can't choose to be born to a different parent. Yet in the case of my mother, if she were to get out and it were to start evaluating what got her into Scientology in the first place, there are very definite things that drove her to be lured in. To me, it's just complete, like apples and oranges, different scenarios. So my recovery is not, what did I do or what was going on in my life that I ended up in a cult? No, it's, I got out of the cult. So now let's evaluate what impact those experiences had and help me understand how I can process things on my own without the indoctrination I learned from a very young age. Mm-hmm. That's my challenge.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I want to dive into this because I think this is a really interesting discussion. And now with cults being around for as long as they've been around, and I have a feeling they've been around, you know, for millennia and probably always will be. As much as we do cult education, still there are people in this world who, you know, have the kind of persona and needs and ego needs to create them or lead them, and others who are looking for something who will follow. And so that's why I think it's always a timely issue, unfortunately. But I do think, you know, when people, I remember talking to people early on, like Dr. Margaret Singer, I remember asking her, you know, the term brainwashing isn't used as much, and how come it's more about mind control? And she said, well, it's kind of a misnomer that the brain isn't washed, that it's manipulated, or it's like a heavy blanket is put over your persona, you know. But then when people leave, you can help get them back to who they were before and their life before. But as you're saying, if you're born into it, then what? And I wonder if there's a way to look at it where still it's not brainwashing. You are still there. Your sense of your core, I think, always is part of who you are, even if you're born and raised. Like when you say that you think about hope, you have hope about things. I don't, you know, I think that's you, you know, that's Claire, no matter what, right? And so to go to like, who am I? And sometimes it's what bothers you that you find out who you are, like what is against your conscience and your value system. And because cults have their own value system, but still there are going to be some things that bother you. Why do they bother you? And to have a sense of sort of crafting that, learning who Claire really is, that couldn't be just absolutely created by another group wholly, even though there's a lot to undo and a lot to untangle.
True. Yeah, that's true. And I did, you're right. You make me realize I did have certain, what I would call Scientology hacks. The one that came to mind was, and again, oh my gosh, it's so much language, but there's TRs, training routines, you know, the drills of communication where it starts with you're just sitting in front of somebody with your eyes closed and you just sit there for 2 hours. Then you do the same with your eyes open. And then you learn how to deliver lines from Alice in Wonderland in a new unit of time. So I had a distinct memory. The first time I was made to do these drills was when I was 7 or 8 years old. And one of the first drills is you're sitting there with your eyes open and the person, your coach, bull baits you and yells at you or tells jokes or does all these things to make you laugh. And I had this very distinct moment and memory of thinking, this seems impossible to me, that how could I possibly not laugh or not react or, you know, so I put up this theoretical bubble and just like plugged it of all the audio. And I was like, that'll work.
That's so great. I love that. I love the confidence that goes with it. Yeah, got this. Mm-hmm, that'll work.
Uh-huh. Didn't really work out very well, but it's funny because I was like, okay, that would work. You know, let me put up my theoretical little, you know, sound bubble.
Right? Yeah. That's so interesting. But I think, right? You're like, oh God, this. Taking you back to the intensity of those moments too, of having to do anything for a number of hours, especially when you're young, is actually a near impossibility. It's like setting people up to fail, unfortunately, and then feel bad about themselves, which I think happens way too often in these groups, especially if kids are treated like adults.
Yeah.
But I think also that's why, you know, I work with people who've been involved in cultic systems where they were told, where they were punished for imagining, for having their creative outlet, for talking about the dream that they had, for, you know, I think because of exactly what you're talking about, you envisioned something. You gave yourself this way of thinking about a bubble that was not, that was going to be impervious to sound. And that you created, which is very cool. And it was powerful to whatever degree it was humanly possible. Right. It's not like the vision failed. It's that you're a kid. You know?
Right. Yeah. No, totally. And even in that same, in that same time period later on, I was just doing the later drills where you ask, do birds fly or do fish swim, over and over and over again, which can seem silly or just bizarre or whatever. But it's weird too that as a child, it's baking in that you're going to keep asking or you're going to keep doing something to somebody, whether they want you to or not, both on the giving and on the receiving end. And I just so did not want to be there. I didn't want to do it. I was upset. And so the person who was my coach was an adult, like 40-year-old guy. And I was just really having a hard time getting through it. And I was just crying. And he was like, are you crying? And I'm like, no, I'm not. And I just lied. because I knew that I, no matter what I said or did, I had to somehow get through it. So that was my resignation as a child. And I wouldn't admit it. It's like, I'm sitting there crying. He's like, are you crying? No, I'm not. I just have something in my eye, you know, whatever.
Something in both of my eyes right now at the same time.
Eyeballs, they cry. They're doing it on their own. It has nothing to do with me.
Wow. Wow. I mean, when you have to come up with things like that, you know, it just shows the ridiculousness of the whole situation. It's such an unfair burden. Going back to this idea of people born and raised, some people are second gens, as they're called, and sometimes third gen, fourth gen. And so there probably need to be some new ways of labeling these kinds of people, because some I've talked to were fourth, sometimes fifth generation in particular cult groups. And this is all they knew. And then they were sometimes the first to leave. And I mean, it can feel terrifying. I'm sure it made it a lot easier that you had Mark.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you don't have a Mark, then to find other people who have left seems to make a huge difference. And I wonder what else, from what you've seen from your own life and other people's, what seems to help when people leave when they were born and raised in something that was not of their choosing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a few different thoughts comes to mind. Number one, it's ironic that it's baked into the indoctrination of Scientology to not trust the outside world and to think that the outside world is dangerous, or that, you know, you will fail, or any of these. And those are emotions that are false. And I say that because, like, take my case. Sure, yes, I had some negative experiences outside of Scientology as a child, but there was nothing that was, you know, isolated instances as an adult, thinking that, oh, you know, this is, it's going to be hard, or, you know, that this baked in mistrust of people is very, very isolating. And so, yes, there are people you can trust, or there are people you shouldn't trust, but holding space for yourself to make your own decisions. Don't do something because I said to, or because you said to, or don't think a certain way. But to me, that's been one of the most important and hardest skills to learn, is to hold that space for me, you know, because it's completely contrary to everything that I was, how I was raised. But, and like I said, it's like a muscle that's been worked too much to just accept things, or, you know, to think about things a certain way. So, and again, for me, one of the ways that I stepped away very intentionally is to just stop using the language, because the language is so many times kind of intricately tied to the control mechanisms. Like, for example, oh, I'm nattering. Nattering in Scientology is saying something bad, like, about somebody else. Just a critical, it can be meaningless or it could be harmful, but it could be anything. But it means that I've done something bad to that person. And so, and again, it's all tied to the smoke and mirrors mechanisms of Scientology. Like, everything comes back to you. You can't have a critical thought about Scientology because that means you've done bad things. So therefore, let me have no critical thoughts is how that mechanism is shut down, of even being able to take a step back to evaluate, like, what do I think? What do I feel? What do I want to do? You know, so that's one thing that I would say is for anyone getting out, like, you know, it's some days will be hard. Some things won't be right for you, but at least try it and see for yourself. What do you think? What do you like? What do you want to do? You know, and certainly finding ways to focus on peace and recovery and healing and just taking time for yourself is so, so important.
Oh, incredibly important. And that it's not selfish, right? Self-care is not selfish.
Right. 100%.
And, you know, I also think about this whole idea of nattering, where gossip, not great, not nice, fine. We can all agree on that. And there are times that you are noticing something that's making you unhappy or you think is wrong, and you want to be able to voice it, and you want to be able to process it without having kind of what I call this programmed emotional obstacle course. Like, you have to kind of hop over this and go around that, like, okay, the thing of, oh, so if I'm thinking this, what have I done wrong? Like, that's going to take you totally off course. And when people say to me, I don't know how I find out if someone's trustworthy. How do I know that? And part of it seems, as you're bringing this up, which is so interesting, is that what gets in the way is just thinking it's okay for you to be judging this person as trustworthy or untrustworthy. And if you see them as not trustworthy, are you then supposed to see there's something wrong with you for seeing that or voicing that? Again, you know, like down this other, talk about, you know, Alice in Wonderland, like, okay.
Right?
You're like, you keep landing in the Mad Hatter's Tea Party by accident. Like, well, how did I keep getting back here? And to get back to the, wait, I need to learn to evaluate. What questions do I need to ask? What do I need to see? And let me not put myself in the mix of needing to do self-judgment, because then I'll never progress in having clarity about who's standing in front of me.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter is that real, you know, real life out here in the real world, yes, sometimes you get burned, but you're not going to get burned if you don't ever give it a shot. And that's kind of the chaotic beauty of life outside of Scientology. Scientology wants to fit everything into an exact box of black or white or this or that, and there's a reason for everything. And so, sure, stepping out of that can feel very unknown and messy and, oh, this, or, you know, I can get hurt. Well, of course, that's real life, you know? It's not, it's just all you can do is try to do better tomorrow or learn from your mistakes. But you're not going to learn if you don't make them in the first place. Take right. chances, take risks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've gone through this so many times with my kids. Like, you know, they'll be, my youngest will often be like, "I'm sorry, Mom." I'm like, you don't need to apologize to me. I just want you to work on X, Y, and Z, and let's try and deal with that differently next time, or, you know, whatever. Think again, just silly examples, but. Yeah, there's no guidebook to this messy, beautiful, chaotic world we live in, especially not one that involves exiting a dangerous and controlling organization like Scientology. But it's quite the path.
It's quite the path. Yes, it is. And I know we have just a few moments left, and I wanted to talk just a little bit, and I want to make sure to leave time also for you to talk about the Aftermath Foundation. But just even in 5 minutes to tackle this idea of how people go after each other, you know, and when it happens a lot, not just with former Scientologists, but in a lot of other groups, there are different factions suddenly of people who don't want you to speak about the group in any kind of negative way, or they don't mind if you speak about the group in a negative way, but they want you to still hold on to the teachings and the philosophy or the technology or whatever it is. And others who don't want you to talk badly about the leader, but are okay with you talking about the organization. There are all these different things. And then the indies and the whatever, all the things, right? And so you want people to feel like now they have a chance to coexist peacefully, and most do, but some will really turn on each other. And I've really wondered about if that's sort of a loss of a feeling of specialness, or if it's that they come from a situation that was so competitive and hierarchical that now when something isn't, they create like who's doing it better and who's doing it the right way, because they still need to get that. So I'm wondering what you make of sort of that chaos, right? That
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree. I've, you know, Mark and I have been speaking out against Scientology now since 2000. Well, Mark started in 2006. I first spoke out, I think, in 2007 or 8. That's a long time. And we've obviously seen so many waves of different perspectives. My personal view on it is, you know, we're talking about people recovering from a very traumatic experience in many cases. And there's naturally hurt in that. But I always just think it's important to focus on the actual goal, which is to expose Scientology. Anything getting into factions or this or that, the other thing, I accept that there are different perspectives, there's different feelings. There's a lot of strong feelings and a lot of strong emotions that are involved in that process of breaking free. And I just consider it, you know, we're each on our own path, whatever path that looks like. Anything I can do to support someone else struggling, I will do that. Mark and I have been doing that for many, many years, you know, and even people who then turned around and hurt us back. And that's okay. I accept that that's just part of the process of dealing and working through a whole boatload of trauma. But again, I don't think it's good to engage in that. I don't support anyone who does. I think it's, you know, from an outside perspective, it's way better to just stay focused on the actual root cause, which is Scientology.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Yes. Yes. And I wonder also, going back to this idea of not being able to address emotions and learning how to deal with your own emotions, that people, I think, are still learning how to do that and maybe also have suppressed certain emotions so that they are leaking out in these ways. They're sort of kind of hurting others because they've been hurt, but they're hurting the wrong people. They're kind of going after the ones who are available to them, but the leadership isn't, or the people who had treated them this way, or the parents who abandoned them are not there. And so it's sort of misdirected.
Right. Absolutely. And I do strongly think that the catalyst of leaning into and creating a beautiful life outside of Scientology can only result in good things. So, you know, that work pouring into, in other words, I'm like, I don't attribute my connection with people in the former Scientology community to be because we came from the same place. It's not that it's not a point of common or shared experience or reality, but more there, the deeper connection is, hey, let's create beautiful lives outside of Scientology. How do we do that? How can I help you to have a better life and be a better person? And so, in other words, look forward, not look back. Because ultimately, that's way more constructive.
Right. Yes. Really important point. And it's a really good perspective on it. I hope people adopt that. It goes sort of along with this positive way that you look at things and your hopefulness. And it's really that, hopefully that's contagious too. And that's something that your kids will be taking from you.
Yeah. And that's not to say some days that's not hard, but.
Oh. Sure. Right.
It's also great to lean into that hardness and learn from it.
Wow. That was beautifully said. So talking about leaning into things, I mean, starting this Aftermath Foundation, helping to create it, helping to keep it going, it's not been without its challenges.
For sure.
And so I would love for people to learn about it and what it does and what you provide.
Absolutely. So the Aftermath Foundation was founded in December 2017. Really, the catalyst for the creation of the foundation was the show, Leah Remini, Scientology in the Aftermath, which, of course, the Aftermath Foundation takes its name from. And our purpose is to help people who want to start over and get out of Scientology. And we understand the sometimes very real barriers somebody can face in trying to make that transition. And so most of the programs we offer are everything from emergency housing to career counseling to community and mentorship support. We've just recently started a therapy group for recovering former Scientologists, which is going very, very well. It's in person, but we're looking to expand to a virtual option as well. We've had a lot of interest in that. So it's all about just helping people get back on their feet so that getting out of Scientology is a more realistic option. And of course, the incredible support we've had for the Aftermath Foundation and the work that we do has been just really encouraging. We've always known that a foundation such as this would then, of course, become a target for Scientology, which it has been, but we're continuing to navigate those road bumps. And we do everything in our power to keep the people we help confidential and to also collaborate with law enforcement, which we do on a regular basis, to just continue to expose Scientology's abuses while offering people a way to get out.
That's fantastic. It helps to really solve this very practical issue for a lot of people who say, I stayed in longer after I was so done because I didn't know where to go and I didn't know if I could make a living and I felt so debilitated. And where was I going to live? And I was leaving my whole family and my friend group. And how do I start again? So it's so great that you help people not only emotionally feel cared for, just knowing that you're there and that you exist, but in a very practical, tangible way with some skills and support that they need to get back on their feet or to get on their feet for the first time.
Yes, no, absolutely. And of course, it's volunteer work, but it brings, and Mark is on the board as well, my husband, it just brings us great joy to help people get out and start over as we were able to. You know, of course, I had Mark to lean into. And so when I was getting off that bus, reuniting with him with only $20 in my pocket, I wasn't feeling desperate or on the, you know, or anything else. It was the first day of the rest of my life. And I want anyone who wants a life outside of Scientology to have that same safety net that they can do it. Yes, it will be hard, but you can do it. If you don't want to continue that existence, you should never have to.
Oh, that's so fantastic. And so there will be a link to the Aftermath Foundation and to the podcast in the show notes. So people make sure to look out for those. It is a total pleasure always to talk to you, to learn from you, to be able to also hear your philosophy about things, which is really lovely, but also to hear about how much you have learned since you've left, but also it shows what's possible and that it's also possible to learn to have your own feelings and to offer solace and sympathy, empathy, kindness, and to have that be woven into your world again, to receive it and to give it is really quite a beautiful thing. So thank you so much, Claire, for today and for everything that you do.
Same to you, Rachel. I appreciate it. Always a pleasure. I always learn so much from you too. So I greatly appreciate your time today.
One more thing before you go. It's so nice to talk to Claire. It's always nice to talk to Claire. I always have a good time. I always learn a lot. And it's nice just to catch up with her and see how she's doing. And I'm so happy for her and what she's created in her life. It is also amazing to see a lot of the people I come across in my work who are joyful and who are smiling, but I also know they have dealt with so much harassment, and you would never know from meeting them. They just are charming and lovely and happy and positive. Maybe not always. Maybe there are moments that are hard, but I'm not quite sure how they put up with all of it. I think part of what happens after a while is that you just start to ignore it as much as you can and just get very determined to continue doing the work that matters to you, that means something to you, that you know is necessary. One of the things that Claire talked about, and I love this quote that she used in my conversation with her, is the chaotic beauty of life outside of Scientology. There are people who will sometimes get involved in a cultic group because they don't love the chaos of life. They want the answers. They want it to be made clear to them. And after a while, that becomes too prescribed and too set, and they miss actually the chaos. They miss the things that just feel spontaneous and the things that aren't just about following rules. People also, by and large, as we talk about Claire, born and raised in groups like Scientology, don't really know what the world feels like, and sometimes really do enjoy the chaos of it. The fact that people might come and go and that people might suddenly want to have a good time and laugh, and no one is telling them not to, and no one is telling them to be serious all the time, like within Scientology. And along with this chaotic beauty of life outside, you get to be able to stop and smell the roses. You get to be able to take time to appreciate life around you. And within Scientology, people are pushed and they're on a time clock and they have to go, go, go. And they don't have time to just enjoy, really, I think, any beauty at all. Something that has always struck me when I hear about cultic groups is the lack of sympathy and the lack of empathy. When you show sympathy for someone else, you show kindness, whether or not you can relate to their experience, but you understand that they might be sad or you understand they might be injured and you want to do something for them. It's a natural impulse, actually, and you have to actually guide people to not have it because it is so natural for most of the population to lean in, to be affected when someone else is hurt. Even babies will respond when someone is crying. Sometimes they'll start crying too. There is a natural connection between people, a feeling connection, but that is severed, not permanently, but while you're in cultic groups. And empathy, which is where you can relate to someone else's experience because you've had something similar happen to you, and then you can empathize with them, is also something kept from people within Scientology, that somehow that's interfering with them and them being able to get past their own emotional moments. But one of the things that we learn about ourselves is that, yes, while we can rely on ourselves to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps and dust ourselves off, it's still nice to be able to receive sympathy. It's still nice to be able to receive empathy, and it doesn't weaken us. It can often strengthen us when we don't feel alone. I do think that the reason that is built into so many different cultic systems to really move away from showing sympathy and move away from showing empathy is because the leader doesn't value that. And the leader, most likely who has narcissistic personality disorder, doesn't understand the idea of showing sympathy, doesn't understand the idea of being empathic. It's a foreign concept. And they might even put it down. I think a lot of people who are narcissistic in their way will put down the things they don't understand or put down the things that they don't possess and can't do naturally themselves. And so you have not only this idea that you can't show it within Scientology, but it is something that is equated with covert hostility, that you're actually showing that you're hostile towards this person by putting your arm around their shoulder. And that actually doesn't make sense. It makes sense within the context of Scientology because if it is a natural impulse and you want to get people to stop doing something that is naturally part of their makeup, you need to make them fear doing it. And if you can tell people, if you want to help someone, you're actually being hostile towards them, and that's the last thing you want to be, then you'll stop yourself. So it's a very clever way of playing that game, unfortunately, and causing people to disconnect from their emotions of wanting to give, of wanting to show support, of wanting to lean in. And so there are people who leave Scientology and other groups like it who need to learn how to do it, or they are able to do it, but need to be given permission that it is an innocent thing, that it's not hostile, that it's not angry, that it doesn't mean you're manipulating. It's very genuine. When you get involved in a group, you want to be able to understand why you're told that certain things are prohibited. And if it really is so that you don't develop connections to other people in the group and you don't lean on other people in the group, that you really somehow need to suffer alone in this organization. And that's the way you grow and that's the way you get strong. But human beings are social beings and we survive by being part of a group. And I think Scientology doesn't really want to have to play that role because L. Ron Hubbard and David Miscavige don't know and didn't know how to play that role. And once again, when someone has a narcissistic bent, they see the world through their lens, and what doesn't matter to them shouldn't matter to you. And what they can't do naturally is something they're going to take away from you. So always wonder why you're being told that something is bad and why you're being told that something is good. It will often give you insight into the person who made up the rules to begin with. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @IndoctrinationPodcast. And for Twitter, find us @@_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.